Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. Two guests today. Delighted to have Stepan Mestrovic back. We've talked about what he has written, and we'll get into it again today because my second guest is a young soldier who has been through a terrible ordeal. I'll let him explain. His name is Bill Hunsaker. I'm delighted to have Bill with us. And rather than have me explain briefly what his situation is, I'll let him do it. But Stepan wrote a very important book. We've discussed it on this program, as I mentioned. It's called The Good Soldier on Trial, a sociological study of misconduct by U.S. military pertaining to Operation Iron Triangle, Iraq. In a nutshell, ordinary soldiers occasionally are hung out to dry to cover up for the crimes of their superiors. That's what happened to Bill Hunsaker. He wasn't alone, and others have gone through the same ordeal. It's very unjust. But in his book, Stepan wrote, or Stepan documented, hundreds of incidents of deceit, chicanery, dubious behavior on the part of the government. Brigade Commander Colonel Michael Steele was involved. He ordered every military-aged Iraqi killed on site. Imagine giving an order like that. It's an unlawful order. But he gave the order. Do you think soldiers in the ranks are going to disobey a colonel or a major or a captain? It's a court-martial offense to do it. They'd go to prison if they disobeyed an order. Automatic court-martial. The colonel says so, the major, the captain, the platoon sergeant, whatever. The order is given. You either carry it out or you pay the price. So they're caught between the devil and the deep blue sea. They literally don't have a choice. You know the old saying, you can't fight City Hall. Well, you sure as hell can't fight the U.S. Army. Don't even try. Stepan, Bill, I welcome you to the program. Stepan, let me let you jump in, and then I'll let you get Bill into the discussion.
Okay. Yes, thanks for having us both. I'm really delighted that Bill is here, because he can talk, of course, more concretely than I ever could about what happened to him and so forth. But, you know, as someone who was interested in this case, the part I would add is that after the mission was carried out, the court-martial procedure itself is unjust and unfair in that the prosecutors put tremendous pressure on the accused to make a plea bargain. And they basically make him an offer they can't refuse, you know, to quote from The Godfather. And that's because we have mandatory minimum sentencing laws, which were passed, which say that if you're convicted of premeditated murder, automatically you get a life sentence. And the question of can you ever even get parole is not automatic either. So under those kinds of pressures, and then, like you said, all the other instances of deceit and pressuring that were going on, 95% of all court-martials are handled basically through plea bargains. The accused pleads guilty. It's a very small percentage that takes a chance and pleads not guilty, and usually with disastrous consequences. So, you know, the system is stacked against the accused soldier in all kinds of ways, not just, as you rightfully pointed out, following the orders, but then the system itself is geared towards producing convictions and not towards producing truth.
Stephen, that is absolutely true. In the U.S. courts, in the civil courts, especially the federal courts, and I've written about this, the odds are greatly stacked against people that prosecutors want convicted. There's literally a conspiracy so often between the judges. Most of them are right-wing judges. The prosecutors are right-wing or they act right-wing. And people going on trial, innocent or guilty, or anything in between, minor stuff that never should be brought to court in the first place. If prosecutors want to get somebody, they're going to get them, and they get right. Very cooperative judges to go along. Just imagine going up in a court-martial where the judge is a military officer representing right. The military. His career is on the line. He either goes along with the system or it's curtains. You know, whatever, if he's a lieutenant, a captain, a major, whatever, they all want to move up and be promoted. If they don't play the game, their career comes to a dead end. They'll probably be rifled out of the service. It's all over. So they go along. The person put right. on trial literally doesn't have a chance, as you say, Stepan. A plea bargain, there really is a rotten deal, but it's better than the other way because things will turn out even worse.
Right, exactly right.
Bill, you want to jump in?
I'm just listening to y'all too, sir. It's like Stephen and Stefan's like a PI firm.
Well, Bill, you went through the system, and you know what it's like. You went through the whole thing. Explain it as you wish to do it, just to some of your own feelings or what you'd like listeners to know about what happened to you.
It's kind of hard to put in words, honestly. I mean, a lot of it is a very confusing time. I mean, like you said, you know, you don't question the orders you're given. Yeah, they may sound fishy or even, you know, deep down that this ain't right, but at the same time, you have a lot of faith and trust in your superiors. You know, you wouldn't question them. By the time Operation Iron Triangle had occurred, we had so much more faith in Colonel Steele than our own brigade-level commanders, because we rarely saw him. We saw Colonel Steele more than our own battalion-level sergeant major and lieutenant colonel. Colonel Steele was out there constantly, and so he'd earned our respect. He was out there a lot, and we'd seen him quite a bit, and so, of course, we wouldn't question what was given. The initial order to kill all military-age males was not in the original operation order that was given the night before it went to Fabermagen. It was just a simple, you know, run-in. It was a terrorist training camp, you know, kill or capture, you know, kill only if you know you're engaged, capture if otherwise. And then the next day, you know, we're at Fabermagen. They have a big, like a frago order, you know, so everyone's gathered around Colonel Steele and the brigade sergeant major. And it's probably a good 200 people, including, you know, U.S. military and Iraqi forces, because it was a joint force. And he verbally gave, you know, the orders to kill all military-age males on the island. And then it was reintegrated down through our own chain of command, from our captain to the first sergeant, through our, you know, platoon sergeant and lieutenant and so forth, so we all understood what was to be done that day. And then, you know, of course, the mission was to be carried out. It was going fairly simple, nothing, you know, crazy. At first, we weren't even seeing anybody. And, of course, you know, what happened. You know, we had captured these individuals, and then supposedly I didn't hear this order personally from the first sergeant, and Colonel Steele likes to say, from what I've heard, from what I've been told, that he likes to say that he gave the order to kill these detainees, which I never said he said that. That order supposedly came down through the first sergeant and on down to the radio man and to us. You know, like I said, I physically never heard it. I heard it discussed, and then it was passed on down to us via our squad leader. And then,
Bill, I honestly believe that this type of order is very standard practice in U.S. wars. So I think the same thing happened in Afghanistan and in previous wars, going back to Vietnam, to Korea. You're fighting troops in the ranks are told is the enemy. And the enemy wants to do you harm, so you need to protect yourself. So shoot first and ask questions later. I think that's basic standard policy. Well, you know, usually civilians are the ones who suffer most, people who certainly want nothing to do with combat going on, but they're there in a combat zone. They're right in the middle of all the action. And in all wars, there is no question that civilians pay the biggest price. And there are literally policies that may not be stated in black and white that basically say, civilians are targets just like anybody else, because you're never sure who the enemy is. So don't take chances. Target everybody. Consider everybody an enemy. And this, I think, is standard policy. And I don't think it's just true about America. I think it's true about other countries in policies to protect their own forces. The idea is winning. How doesn't matter. Of course, international law matters a great deal, but it simply is disregarded. And I must add more as well, Bill. most you is I remember what your mother told me, and I met her because she visited me in Chicago, and I think, as I recall, what she said, that you really had a passion to go into the military. You never could have imagined they would treat you the way they did. It's very hard to it's very hard for anybody young. I remember when I was your age, it's very hard to imagine that your country doesn't stand up for what's right. I was in the Army back in the 1950s. I was lucky. I went in after Korea and before Vietnam, so I never saw combat. I didn't go through. I didn't have a chance to endure what you did. It would have been a completely different situation for me. But it's hard for young people to realize that, that your government gets into a war that may be won for the wrong reasons. There's no question that the official story told about the war in Iraq was a bald-faced lie. Iraq posed America no danger whatsoever. There were no weapons of mass destruction. There was no nuclear program. There was nothing to suggest, nothing to warrant an attack on a country that was a non-belligerent country, threatened nobody. Saddam, of course, was a tyrant. He was not a pleasant person to live under. At the same time, Iraq was the most developed country in the region. Iraqis had wonderful services and benefits. If anybody went up against the government, they got into very, very big trouble. They could end up in prison. They could end up dead. Well, it's not just Iraq. This can happen in lots of places. Try going up against the U.S. government. Try going up against the Western European countries. Try doing it effectively enough. Anything can happen to you. You're fair game. Of course, usually you don't see wars erupt between Western countries. Could happen, but usually it doesn't. But America went into Iraq, the official story, it was for false pretenses. In one respect, I could say, it's the oil, stupid. It's the oil. Iraq has lots and lots of oil. It also had an independent leader. It didn't matter whether Saddam was a tyrant or a Democrat or anything in between. That's a phrase I like to use. The only thing that mattered was, would he surrender Iraq's sovereignty to America, or would he maintain his independence? He maintained his independence. He cooperated with America, but he maintained his independence. That was his death knell. He got targeted for regime change, another common phrase. I didn't make it up, but I use it all the time. Regime change, if you can't do it one way, you try it another way. Lots of ways to enforce regime change. Coup d'etats, targeted assassinations, economic sanctions. If all the methods don't work, war. The war on Iraq was planned at least right after 9/11. I think it was well before 9/11. I think it was planned in the early 1990s. Paul Wolfowitz, Assistant Secretary of Defense under George Herbert Walker Bush, I think he was a lead instigator. And it wasn't just Iraq, Bill. It was Iraq, Iran, Libya, Syria, and two or three other countries. And I wrote about General Wesley Clark several times. He was NATO commander in the 1990s. After 9/11, he visited the Pentagon. He talked to the high brass there. They told him what I just said, that these countries are targeted for regime change. And he was astonished. I don't know why. He was a four-star general. He was the guy who for 78 days bombed the living daylights out of Yugoslavia, out of Kosovo and Serbia. Well, that was a NATO war. It was an unauthorized war because the Security Council didn't authorize it. So it was an illegal war. But he led the war. There was more ordnance dropped on Serbia and Kosovo in 78 days. I read this. It's hard to believe it's true. It was used in World War II. I think maybe they're talking about the power of the weapons and the ferocity of the attack. But Wesley Clark knows all about aggressive war. Well, he said he was shocked when he found out, when he was told, that these countries were targeted for regime change, that there were wars planned against these countries. So there was nothing spoken about Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. None of this was in the news at that time. It came out later, and he was at the Pentagon, several weeks after 9/11. I think the Afghan war had just begun around the 7th of October, as I remember. So it might have been around mid-October that he went back to the Pentagon. But this stuff is well planned. When wars are waged, you don't launch them overnight. It takes many, many months of planning. They're on the books. They're on the shelf. They get revised if they're not used right away. There have been war plans against Iran for years, maybe as far back as the last decade. They're constantly updated. They could be implemented any time. Well, we know the situation in Iraq. You know what you went through, Bill. The war in Iraq hasn't ended. The suffering of the Iraqi people continues. That's a story all to itself. Stephen, let me let you jump back in with some more comments. I didn't mean to take so much time.
Well, I'd like for Bill to go into the first part of your comments, which was about how the Army treated him. I mean, I think you may be right about the theory, but, you know, Bill is a ordinary infantry soldier. He's not going to know all these geopolitical theories and devices. But what I know as an outsider of what he went through from the court transcript, and what I know about other soldiers is this. The military, before they put him on a court-martial, routinely puts them in solitary confinement. And the prosecuting attorneys always say, oh, we have to do this because we have to make sure that the accused and the co-accused don't speak to each other before the trial. They come up with all kinds of excuses why they have to put him in solitary confinement. And I've seen this in case after case. Sometimes the soldier, if they wait for the trial a year, or even in Jeremy Morlock's case, it was 2 years. They're 2 years in solitary confinement. I've stepped into some of those cells. They're absolutely tiny, bleached white. All you've got is a bed, you've got a toilet, and you've got a light that's on 24 hours a day, so the soldier cannot sleep. Basically, it's torture. There's all kinds of studies that show that solitary confinement starts to have negative effects on the brain, on judgment, on will to live. And under those circumstances, after they've drained them of their energy and judgment and morale, they put a piece of paper in front of them and say, here, this is your plea bargain, you have to sign it. So I would really like to hear from Bill, if he's up to it, to talk about his confinement at the naval brig in Charleston a little bit, and about his solitary before the trial, if he wants to.
Oh, sure. Matter of fact, I'll back up all the way back to Iraq when they first detained us. They sent us to a detainment center in Arab John, Kuwait. And it was just a bunch of tents and such inside a tall fence with a chain link fence. It was green. And they had like this green mesh in the chain link fence so people couldn't really see in, and it's kind of vague seeing out.
Mm-hmm.
When we first went there, they stuck us all in cages. Literally, it was cages. It was angle iron, and it had kind of like a grating or rat wire that covered that, your toilet and your sleeping slab, which was a 90 degree, which is probably about 6 foot long, maybe 7 foot long, just two pieces of metal that formed a 90-degree angle. So you had like this rectangular slab in there that they had a mattress on. And then your toilet, which was automatic toilet in there, was also in the cage with you. And I kind of measured it. I didn't have a measuring tape. But when I was able to stick my hand up, I could, touch the top of it and, side to side. So it's probably estimate 7 by 7 foot, steel cage. And they put all three of us in these cages, and then we get these psychopathy interviews by a this place is ran by the Naval, by the way. And all their guards were either policemen or prison guards of some sort in their civilian life, because these were all Naval Reserve or National Guard or whatever their nomenclature is. And so all these people have experience dealing with convicts or criminals of some kind. And so they have this reservist naval psychologist lady. She was a major, I believe, at the time, that comes in and she interviewed all of us. And when she got to me, she asked me, you know, how do you feel? You know, if we put you in general population, you know, you think you're going to lash out against the other inmates. Well, first of all, what they don't tell you when you first get locked up, you're a detainee. They cannot put you in general population when you're a detainee. You're not allowed to go and stay with other inmates that have that are already doing, you know, break time, so to speak. And, of course, I told her, and, of course, I was angry, too. I told her, I said, well, what do you think I'm going to do? You just dragged me out of combat. I'm pretty pissed off right now. You put me in a room full of dudes who... I'm liable to bust one of them in the head, you know, of course. Then she listed me as a danger to others, and I wound up spending probably a good 3 months in that cage. And, it, and of course, anyone that's been to Kuwait would know it's about 120 degrees in the shade in the daytime. And these cages are intense, GP mediums. And it was hot as hell. I could reach up and touch the top of that damn cage, and it was... it would literally burn my fingertips. I would lay on the metal floor because they had air conditioners in there, now mind you, but they were angled towards the floor, and so the metal was cool. That's where I would lay, and during the daytime anyway. And we were only allowed to come out at night, so our rec time, which was about an hour or 45 minutes, and in that rec time, you either got a phone call and a shower, or you could work out and get a shower, but you couldn't, you know, go over an hour being outside the cage. So we'd spend, you know, about... 23 hours of the day, you know, in this cage. You know, of course, bugs would get in and stuff like that. You know, the guards themselves, you know, they did their job. They were actually nice people. They did not treat me bad at all, the naval guys. You know, they bring me extra food when they weren't supposed to. You know, I mean, they were generally, you know, kind people. They just couldn't take me out of the cage because of what I got labeled with. And, of course, the ants would come in and attack my food and whatnot. And, yes, the lights are on 24 hours a day. They never go out because their excuse is, well, we got to be able to see you. But for the longest time, it was just me in this tent by myself in this cage with lights on, nobody watching me, you know, not a soul. And someone would come in maybe once an hour to make sure I was still breathing. And then, like I said, about 2 or 3 months go by, and then Article 32 comes up, and they take us to Camp Tafaba Spiker. And, of course, they got all three of us together now. You know, they had stuck Claggett in a tent by himself and Gerard in a tent by himself prior to this, and then they got us all back together, and they take us all to Spiker. You know, our own guys took us to Spiker, and they were, you know, people from our own unit. They were really cool. You know, they were sympathetic. They, you know, they weren't a bunch of dicks, so to speak. Pardon my language, but that's the best way to put it. And, you know, they took care of us. But once we got to Spiker, of course, the Army, in its infinite wisdom, loves to put the worst NCO in charge of handling something like this, and this dude was a complete idiot. You know, we had no food, no water. They stuck us in each, you know, each person in an individual tent in Tent City over at, in Spiker. And I even asked him, I said, well, what about water and food? And he goes, oh, I don't know, but I'll get back to you on that. We scrounged for our own water, and our guards, who were, like I said, men from our own unit, went to the defect on their own and brought us back food, or went and bought stuff from the commissary for us. We know they took care of us, not someone that was assigned to us. And we spent the next 2 weeks having to bathe and sleep and live in shackles. I had shackles on my ankles. I had the belly chain on that, you know, and I had the cuffs and the box, which the belly chain goes around your belly, and it slips through this plastic box that holds your handcuffs in place. So there's no play in your hands. You're locked in this box. And I had to shower in ankle shackles. They wouldn't take those off. You know, I was in the shower. They took the belly chain and everything off so I could scrub myself, but the chain still stayed on my feet. And we lived in those things for about 2 weeks. The only time they really came off was when we went to the attorney's office. So they had to walk us before one of the guards, you know, who was a soldier, thank God, that had common sense. It's like, you know what, let's get a Humvee for these guys. There's no sense in making these guys march down this road like this. And, you know, they drive us back and forth. I say, if it wasn't for these guards who were young soldiers, you know, private specialists and stuff like that. If it wasn't for them, we'd probably be in a lot worse situation. Those guys, you know, thankfully had common sense to take care of us. They were good men. And I think
Go ahead. Just jump in. What I think it's important for your listeners to know that during this whole time, under the Constitution, you're supposed to be innocent until proven guilty, number one. And number two, there's no earthly reason to have you shackled like that and to be in a cage, because there are other people accused of murder who walk around freely, you know, who are not shackled, who can shower and so forth. You know, they choose to follow the Constitution for some people in low-profile cases where, you know, not much is at stake and they don't want to force and coerce the accused. So there's a lot of arbitrariness that went into the Army treating you that way. So I just want to emphasize that. But I'm sorry to interrupt, but Okay. So go ahead with your story, and especially how you got to Charleston and how that continued.
Yeah, I'll get there in a moment. There's still a lot between here and there. It's a long story. But, so, you know, we pretty much lived like that for 2 weeks. When I slept in this chain, you know, the belly chain, which thankfully, you know, I get a certain guard, you know, he was pretty cool. He's like, hey, man, I'm just going to take these off, just leave the ankle ones on and stay under this blanket. So when they come in, they don't see you unchained, you know. So I still had to sleep on my back because the chain stayed around my belly. Just in case they came in, I could slip my hands back through the cuffs so he wouldn't. So I was looking out for him as much as he was looking out for me, because he felt it was wrong too. And, you know, so I kind of looked out for him and so on. So thank God I had him. And like I said, we were like this for 2 weeks, you know, and it got to the point sometimes where the cuffs were almost cutting through my hands, because it would leave real deep, almost black-purple ligature marks around my wrists from where the cuffs and the box would dig in, because, you know, we didn't have our good guards all the time. So, and an Article 32 was commencing, and we met our attorneys, you know, Mr. Waddington and Mr. Berggren, who was quite a character, by the way. He's like something out of The Sopranos looking at him. And a firecracker on top of that. Very funny man, good man. And, of course, we went through, you know, that whole shindig. And, you know, they brought a lot of our own soldiers and other comrades in to, you know, make statements and so on and so forth. And we got marched. I remember this happening to me. I can't speak for the other two. I know I got marched in front of them one time because I had to go take a shower. I was just wrapped in a towel with the belly chain and the cuffs and the ankle bracelets on still. And some of my own comrades actually turned around and turned their back on me, because I don't think they meant it as an insult, because some of them actually came and spoke up on my behalf, but they couldn't stand to see me like that. But still, it was embarrassing to be marched, you know, to shower so I could wash myself, wearing these chains and nothing but a towel. And, you know, of course, I'm sure you already talked about the things at the Article 32. You know, we went through all that. And then they took us back to Camp Arab John. And we were there for another few months. We didn't leave there till probably October. And, of course, we got another interview, went through the whole system again. And I tried my best to stay out of that cage again. So I kind of told the psychologist lady what she needed to hear, because they stuck me right back in that cage. I mean, right away. They didn't waste any time. Gerard and Claggett, I believe, went back to their tents for the time being. And, you know, I told the lady, I said, look, you know, I'm not going to hurt anybody. Just don't put me back in this damn cage. There's no point in me staying in here, okay? And thankfully, you know, she was like, okay, I believe you. And they put me in a tent, and which was a lot better than that cage, even though it could get pretty hot in there. I mean, it was better than the cage. And then they came and got us and took us to Charleston a few months later, I think in October or November time frame. I can't really remember which month. And they took us to, they took me to Charleston, well, me and Gerard to Charleston in South Carolina. And they took Claggett to Fort Knox. Now, what I'm going to tell the listeners, which is kind of ironic about this, is me and Gerard's family is in Tennessee and Missouri real close, but they've put us in Charleston. Claggett's family, it lives in Charleston, but they put him all the way out at Fort Knox. You know, I mean, there's such things as coincidence, but I almost don't believe in this one. It's almost like they purposely kept us apart from our families at this point. It just seems suspicious.
Sure
I can't say that was their intention, but it certainly looked that way.
Oh, it is their intention, Bill. That's exactly what they want to do.
Right.
They want to inflict pain. They turn the screws. They want to make it as tough as possible on you. And I'll throw one comment in. What you went through is exactly what others in your situation go through as well. Standard policy, you know, make the little people suffer the most. You never should have been there in the first place, but they did, and they wanted to make life as miserable as they could for you, and they,
right.
and they sure know how to do it.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
Now, Charleston is a naval brig. It's ran by the Navy. And Fort Knox is Army, ran by the Army. And Charleston, in most military regulations, how the states, when you get to a RCF, which is a regional correctional facility, which is generally you have people that are sentenced that are there, but they generally don't have over a 7-year sentence or a 10-year sentence.
Bill, can I interrupt you just one moment?
Yes.
Hold your thought right there. The music means we need to take a short break. We'll pick it right up where you left off when we come back.
Okay.
This is Mike Fader, host of The Turning Point and Occupied Territory, and you're listening to PRN.FM, your very best source for progressive programming.
Hi, I'm Karen Hartglass, host of It's All About Food. Join me this Tuesday, March 26th, which is my fourth anniversary hosting It's All About Food. My guest will be Carol Adams, author of The Sexual Politics of Meat, and Jasmine Singer, co-founder of Our Hen House. They are both contributors in the new book, Defiant Daughters, talking about how women have the power to change the world. That's on It's All About Food, Tuesday, March 26th at 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, everyone. My name is Beattie Cohan. I want to welcome you to my new Ask Beattie show. I am a psychotherapist, a sex therapist, an author, speaker, columnist, and national radio and television expert guest. We're going to be talking about love, relationships, and sex. We're also going to be discussing mental health issues that we're hearing about in the media. And you will also have an opportunity to call me and ask me about any personal problems that you may be experiencing. So join me on the Progressive Radio Network every Tuesday evening at 7 p.m. I'll talk to you then.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to invite you to listen to Warrior Connection on the Progressive Radio Network. Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we're doing the best we can for the veterans of our nation. Warrior Connection is an ongoing discussion with veterans, scientists, politicians, journalists, reporters, and doctors about the health and environmental effects of war on our nation's veterans. Our purpose is to provide the information necessary for all veterans to lead a productive life. Thank you very much, and God bless America.
This is Professor Mickey Huff, Director of Project Censored. Join me, along with the head of the Media Freedom Foundation, Dr. Peter Phillips, for the Project Censored show every Monday morning at 11 Eastern Time, right here on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. For the past 36 years, Project Censored has covered the news that doesn't make the news and tells you why. By highlighting underreported stories and providing cutting-edge media analysis, we can counter the corporate media's top-down, managed news propaganda. Be the antidote to the truth emergency we face. Be media literate. So don't miss the Project Censored show every Tuesday morning at 11 Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Tune in and be part of media democracy in action. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
This is PRN, the comprehensive news source for the world's progressive community. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
on with Stepan Mestrovic and Bill Hunsicker. Bill, let me let you pick up where you left off. Hope you retained your thought, but you know roughly where you were. Continue with what you were explaining.
Yes, like I said, after Kuwait, after Arab John, they took us back to Charleston, South Carolina, and it's a regional correctional facility, which for short they call it the RCF, and is ran by the Navy. And you have Marine Corps that works there, you have Air Force that work there, and you also have some Army that work there. And, of course, when you go there, you know, they run you through the spiel. You know, a Marine gets up there and goes, "You will not do this in my prison." You know, some Marine, you know, MP or some kind trying to act like a hard ass, you know, to a bunch of combat vets, and it's just, you know, which is kind of funny. You know, and you go through the whole spiel, again, of getting strip searched and this and that, you know, which, okay, don't bother me none, you know. I'll do this already. I'm used to it. They take you in, they lay out the rules, and depending on your crime, they put you straight into DSEG. Now, because of the sensitivity of me and Gerard, they had to keep us separated. They put me on one side in one room, and they put him in a completely different room. But we were locked in our cells for a good 3 weeks before they let us out all the time. It was just like being back in Arab John, except not in a desert. You know, we were locked down 23 hours a day. The only difference is we weren't allowed to have books, writing material. The only thing we were allowed to have, well, we couldn't have writing material or anything until after 5 o'clock or some time of the day. The only thing we were allowed to read was a Bible, and you couldn't get that until after a certain time of day, and I couldn't remember what the time was. You know, of course, we had to get up and shave and get in uniform every day and make our bed, but we weren't allowed to sit or lay in our bed until a certain time of day, which is around 5 or 6 o'clock. So all we have is this little desk in our cells that we were allowed to sit in, you know, with nothing to do for a good 3 weeks. And, of course, you know, I talk to people every day and say, look, you know, I have not been convicted of anything just because of what you are charging me with on charge alone. You're keeping me in here. Now, where anyway is this right? Thankfully, they had some good-minded people there, which I've ran into more often than not at these facilities, some people who actually use common sense and are decent people. There was an Air Force major there. He was a great guy, and he agreed. He's like, look, I see where you're coming from. I'm going to do my best to get you out of here. And he was a man of his word. He got us both out of the cells. You know, we just weren't allowed to go in a general population. We're allowed to wander around on one side. You know, we had to stay away from each other, but it didn't matter. We were in two separate units anyway, so it was okay. And so, you know, I was allowed to I still couldn't read books until a certain time. I turned a TV on until a certain time, so I just wandered around this area aimlessly, you know, all day, talking to the guards on occasion, you know, to entertain myself, but It wasn't as bad as being locked in a cell all day. That was really boring. Of course, I had a camera in there, too, and it watched me all day. Then, like I said, after about 3 weeks of that, you know, just wandering around there, that major, he decided to go a step further, and he's like, look, just to get you some interaction, you know, you're going to be here 1 week, and then we're going to put you out in general population with other detainees, other guys that haven't been convicted yet, just so we can get you some people interaction, because he didn't feel that me just wandering around do something. Me and Gerard would just switch off every other week so we could be around people, because he didn't feel what we were stuck in as being, you know, kosher. And, you know, we'd done that for a few months. I took a couple trips down to Hopkinsville Jail, Christian County Jail, and, you know, so we could speak with our attorneys and do this and that in a hearing or two, you know. And then after a certain point, when I decided to take my PTA after it was laid out on me, you know, I decided to sign it and take it, they took me down to Hopkinsville Jail. And, of course, because of my charge, you know, the county jail threw me into solitary confinement. And, well, for other reasons, a lot of people don't realize, in a civilian jail, military is not allowed to be held with civilian criminals. They had to be segregated. You know, they generally have a special block just for federal military people, you know. But in my case, you know, they didn't, I guess they were full or had a problem or whatever the case may be. I wound up in a solitary confinement block. And I was in there for a couple months. And now, mind you, a solitary confinement block in this county jail has no window. It's a small cell, too. It's actually a lot worse than a military holding facility. A military holding facility feeds you actually quite generously. You get fed pretty well. You know, it may not always taste good, but you get a lot of it. And you have choices, which is nice. When you go to a county jail, people don't get that either. That civilian jails are a lot worse than military jails. You don't have much of a choice. And you know, we get our food every day, and it comes on a little tray. And you know, of course, county jail, they feed, you know, they feed you bare minimum. I was allowed to have an iPod in there, which was a plus because, like I said, you know, they allowed them to have that in the county jail, but they are starting to take them away from other inmates because of that military. Oh, go ahead. Excuse me?
No, go ahead, Bill.
Okay. But because I was military, the guards were cool with me, and they allowed me to have my iPod to waste time, to have something to do, you know, so that was nice of them. But mind you, you only have library call once a week, and you're only allowed to have two books, and that lasts you all week, which when you're in solitary confinement, don't last you 2 days. And, you know, but you had other people on the block, and your feed tray was open, you know, all the time, so you're able to talk to people. So it's not truly solitary. You're just locked in there all day, and it gets quite boring. And did that, went to my hearing, you know, where they sentenced me to life, but I got my 18-year PTA, and so wound up getting 18 years. Came out of county probably weighing close to 130 pounds. Because, you know, he didn't get fed a whole lot, and I lived off of ramen noodles or cheese popcorn. And they took me and Claggett in the same van up to Leavenworth. And once again, we're under the control of people from our own unit. They're MPs, but they're attached to our unit down the street. And thankfully, these guys were super great, too. They're good people. They didn't keep us in cuffs. They stopped off to let us eat, you know, like normal soldiers, you know, all the way to Leavenworth. You know, they are great guys. But once we got to Leavenworth, you know, we walked ourselves in. We went the whole shindig getting strip search again. And then you got guards trying to act tough again, trying to scare you a little bit, which didn't really work. And then you go to little holding area there, which is standard operating procedure for when you're going into Leavenworth. And you get to stay down in what they call the SHU, which is a special housing unit, you know, for 30 days while you're in process and do all this and that before you come up to general population. Now, when I went in to the SHU in reception, as they call it, it's a lot different than they do it now. Apparently, they live down there for quite some time now until they have space upstairs. And things are done different, apparently. I don't know this for a fact. This is what, you know, I was told when I was in general population. Of course, by the time something goes from inmate B to inmate C, D, all the way to Z, it's changed every time. But apparently, from what I've been told, the guys in reception now are locked down, you know, from 5 or 6 in the morning to like 5 in the evening for whatever reason, if that's even true, is just what I heard. But for me, we didn't have to be locked down. We came out, we wandered around, you know, in a little, whatever area we had. You know, me, Gerard, and Claggett were all together. You know, we're all sitting there talking, you know, no problems with each other. And then after 30 days pass, they take you up to general population. And then, of course, 6 years later, I'm now here, finally out. So
now, let me jump in just a minute. Stephen, I want to let you jump back in. Claggett was Corey Claggett, PFC Corey Claggett. And, Stephen, you testified on behalf of his clemency hearing. Talk about your involvement in all of this. I mean, this is the stuff that never gets in the U.S. news. Americans simply have no idea about any of this. Total ignorance. They don't realize how the forces that their country sends overseas, supposedly to fight for their country, end up being mistreated so badly. We've got about 12, 13, 14 minutes left, Stephen. I want to let you have these comments.
Sure. I really appreciate Bill telling this story because, like you said, I think Americans don't know these details, and I'm really happy that he was able to relay them. And before I answer your question, I just want to say in all my books, I've tried to stress that we should be treating these soldiers with dignity and respect. They are innocent until proven guilty, and even after they're convicted under this pressure, I still think they deserve the dignity and respect of being soldiers who are willing to put their lives on the line for us, and they deserve much better from us than being treated as if they were terrorists. And what Bill was describing, being put in cages and this kind of treatment, I mean, that's how terrorists are treated, and I don't think that's how we should be treating our soldiers. Having said that, yes, I testified at a number of clemency hearings for both Bill Hunsaker and Corey Claggett. And what I emphasized always was that this was an illegal order that was given, that there was a lot of evidence, sworn testimony, that Colonel Steele did give that order, and that therefore the responsibility of these soldiers was far less than just treating it like premeditated murder. You cannot treat these kinds of crimes the same as if this had happened in New Jersey or Houston, this happened in the combat zone, rules of engagement, you know, structure. It never worked. The board would just listen, not even politely. They looked bored, and they never reduced the sentence. On one of the clemency hearings, I think your listeners should know, Bill Hunsaker's battalion commander, Lieutenant Colonel, at that time Colonel Nathaniel Johnson, came in and testified. And so Bill's own battalion commander was asking the board to reduce Bill's sentence and to let him out early. And he spoke about how he, as his battalion commander, got into disagreements with Colonel Steele about the order. And he himself felt tremendous inability to, you know, protest, to like you would say, you were talking about low-ranking soldiers are not allowed to question. Well, here you had a battalion commander, a lieutenant colonel, who was not allowed to question, and he was threatened with losing his job and derailing his career. So Colonel Johnson testified to that effect, and still the board would not take that into account at all. I mean, I thought that was pretty incredible. That,
yes, Stephen, if you don't mind, I'd like to interject real quick and just...
Sure.
Colonel Jackson wasn't the only one, or Johnson, I can't remember his name anymore.
Johnson stuck up
for my behalf. I had my platoon sergeant. He showed up at my hearing, and he too got on the stand and testified on my behalf and told him, you know, I was a good person. So he's one of the best soldiers I ever seen, you know, and, you know, he did well. He was ostracized for his act and was pretty much bumped down from his responsibilities, and they put him in crap jobs ever since, from what I was last told of him.
Mm-hmm.
Because my mom, I think, tried speaking to him one time, and that's what she was informed of.
Right. So. Well, I think the bottom line here is that the Army made sure that the details of how that order was given would never be fully aired. I mean, some of that came out at the Article 32, but none of it came out at the later trials because of the plea bargains and because of other strategies that the Army used. So they never wanted that aired and you know, examined and analyzed.
Yes, at my hearing, apparently I wasn't in the room for this. This is what my attorney at the time, what he was told and what was relayed to me, that they took him in there because a lot of this was in the back rooms, and he was pretty much threatened. And they told him, so if I ever mention Colonel Steele or the first sergeant during my hearings or anything like this, they will take away my PTA, and I will spend the rest of my life in prison. It shook him up so bad he could not speak straight. At my hearing, he did not know what to say. He had everything planned out. He knew what he was going to do. But when he got hit with this, you know, right hook all of a sudden, he was caught up. He was really shooken. He did not know how to act after that.
Right, and I can just confirm that your attorney also told me that independently. Exactly what you said, he told me that that's what happened, and he was shocked. But he was just told outright not to mention, or they would take away your deal. That's right.
It's again more evidence that the game is completely cooked, and people like you, Bill, simply don't have any recourse but to accept what's given to you, and it isn't very much, and if you don't accept it, then the price is a much greater one. It's a rotten system, and it's always the people on the low end of the echelon that pay for the crimes of the superiors, and they walk away scot-free. I wrote another article about two Colonel Steeles in Iraq. One was involved in torture, and the other was the Colonel Steele, who was your brigade commander. Again, it's a rotten system, and there's nothing anybody can do about it. And the orders come right down from the top. So the system is rotten at the top, and it filters all the way down to the lower ranks who pay the price. Terrible.
Yeah, and I should say that Corey Claggett is still awaiting his, I don't know if it's parole hearing or clemency hearing, but it's coming up first Thursday in April. So in some senses, Bill is very fortunate to be out because Claggett is still in. And, you know, this also takes a huge toll on their families. I mean, Bill doesn't have to get that personal, but I do know from Corey Claggett's family, his mother has developed all kinds of medical conditions just from the stress and the worry, the constant stress and worry about her son. So, you know, it's not like just these soldiers are put in prison, but in a sense, you know, their whole families are punished from just, you know, constant stress.
Yeah, it's true. The family suffers with the individual. I mean, this is true whether it's something of a civil matter when individuals are sent to U.S. prisons for any charge, whether they're small or greater ones. Most of them are nonviolent. So many of them are drug-related. Most of them are very minor stuff that at most should rise to the level of misdemeanors that maybe should get a hand slap or a small fine, but especially drug abuse, simple possession, if it happens more than once especially, people could go to prison for a long time, and family members suffered along with the person put in prison. And when they come out, their troubles don't end. Bill, I certainly hope you'll have a much easier time ahead, but they've certainly put you through the third degree, and you deserve much better. Don't expect any apologies. They don't come. But you're very young in your life, Bill. Early in your life, you've gone through a terrible ordeal. Maybe you'll want to write a book about it someday. It would be a heck of a story to tell.
Maybe. We'll see. Be honest, I mean, it wasn't all that bad. I mean, it'd take a lot more than that to break me. You know, I stuck it out. Now I'm here today. Thankfully, I'm out of prison. Thanks to my mother, my family support. A lot of people supported me. My local leaders here in this community did. A lot of people in Washington supported me. A lot of guys at the prison supported me. You know, there was good people out there. You know, there's more good than bad. Unfortunately, some the bad have more power. You know, Leavenworth, a lot of guards are great people. You know, like anybody else, you're going to have your bad apples, you know, on the inmate side too. But for the most part, you know, it wasn't all that bad. You know, it's only as bad as what you make it. It's only bad if you let it get to you, you know. And to me, I see it as defeat. I wouldn't let them break me in such a manner. But you do see people get broken. You know, you see them get overweight. You see them get depressed. They put them on 20 different kinds of medication. And then, you know, like Corey Claggett, he's on, I think, a ton of medication. And he put on a lot of weight over the years, last time I seen him. You know, but that's how a lot of people find solace, or that's the institution's answer to fixing some people.
It's not easy putting up with injustice, and it certainly is not easy being in solitary confinement. Stefan, I want to let you have the last word. Very briefly, I've written about solitary not having gone through it myself, but I gave an example. I'll just state very quickly. I said, imagine being forced to stay in your bathroom, a windowless bathroom for 24 hours with enough room to lie down, enough water, enough food barely to get by. Imagine how you'd feel after 24 hours under those conditions. And my punchline was, imagine spending years or the rest of your life that way. I don't think anybody can imagine that.
That's right. And, you know, Bill is very tough. There's no doubt about it. But I noticed these soldiers are trained, because they are very strong people, to, you know, to be that positive as Bill is. to see even going to prison as another mission to endure. I've heard that a lot from soldiers. But the objective reality, it really was horrible what they did to Bill. And, you know, again, I agree with what you said, that that's a wonderful analogy about being locked up in your bathroom. I think most people can't because they're always on some electronic device or iPad or iPod or something to distract them. But, you know, as a social scientist, I can tell you there are studies, objective, verifiable studies, that regardless of how you feel, people are social beings. They actually need to be talking with, in face-to-face interaction with other humans. It's true for animals as well. And when you deprive them of that, it's the worst kind of punishment, and it has an immediate effect upon the brain, upon judgment, upon all kinds of bodily functioning, so that, you know, there's going to be rare exceptions like Bill who are very tough, but for most people, it will affect the body. I mean, depression is your body reacting to lack of stimulation, lack of hope, to a feeling of being trapped, and you know, there's just no reason for it. When you look at it objectively, and all the story, the entire story that Bill just gave you, there was no reason to put him in shackles, to put him in those cages. He was on an army or naval basis the whole time. He was in secure facilities surrounded by people who had access to guns at any time. I mean, nobody was in danger because of these accused soldiers. There was no possibility of them escaping. They're in the army. So there's really no rational reason for them to be treated this way. And, you know, I think, you know, somebody just has to scratch their head about that and say, then why were they treated like this? And I think it's because, first of all, most Americans don't know that's how our soldiers are treated. And second, if they do know, I don't think they would know how to go about changing it.
Well, exactly right. Exactly right. And, of course, they don't know. Nothing about this is reported in the major media. Literally a blanket silence. So virtually nothing comes out. And if there ever is any information that comes out, Bill, and Stepan, like in a New York Times article, it might be a fairly lengthy one, and it might end up in paragraph 22. Most people never get past the first two or three paragraphs. That's the way the system is run. We are just about out of time. I hear the music in the background. Bill, I want to thank you. You were very, very, very courageous to come on air and explain to listeners what you've been through. I wanted to leave it open-ended for you, as I explained when we spoke earlier this morning. I didn't in any way want to pressure you or have you do anything that could cause yourself more harm. You've already endured much more than anybody should ever have to go through. But you did a yeoman job. My hat's off to you. I support you. You have a wonderful mother. I've met her. She was strong. She supported you. It was wonderful being able to meet her in Chicago. She had to work today, or she would have come on the program as well. Stepan, I thank you for coming on. I look forward to having you back. We certainly won't let this story drop. It's a big one, and those are the ones that I want to feature most often on this program. The stuff you never get in the mainstream. You're going to get it all the time on this program. Join us tomorrow, same time. Make it a regular habit.